large objects appear to have smashed into the European ice cap. In this connection, it may be of relevance that recent high-resolution sonar scans of the English Channel, the floor of which was above water during the Ice Age, have revealed evidence of cataclysmic flooding there in the form of a 400-kilometer-long network of submerged and partially infilled valleys carved into the bedrock. The data show a collection of landforms that, taken together, indicate a catastrophic flood origin, state the authors of a study published in Nature. The study specifically likens these now submerged landforms to the Cheney-Palouse terrain of the channeled scabland of Washington, USA. The authors state that they cannot resolve the absolute timing of the flooding events. They do conclude, however, that their study provides the first direct evidence that a mega-flood event was responsible for carving the English Channel Valley network. Our observations are consistent with erosion by high-magnitude flows, as in the channeled scabland. 5. Altogether, more than 50 million square kilometers of the Earth's surface were affected by impacts and airbursts of fragments of the Younger Dryas comet, some large, some smaller, but all devastating in their effects, extending from North America right across the Atlantic Ocean and across Europe, with the final rain of fragments falling as far afield as the Middle East. 6. The combined effect of these multiple impacts, particularly the immense freshwater floods into the Arctic and Atlantic Oceans that followed, set off the Younger Dryas cooling event, itself a cataclysm on a truly global scale that resulted in the extinction of huge numbers of animal species and pressed humanity very hard. 7. The human costs of the disaster might not have been confined to the complete destruction of hunter-gatherer cultures, such as the Clovis people of North America. The possibility must be considered that an advanced civilization, now lost to history, might also have been obliterated. Spring is coming. What is particularly striking is that the very radical climate changes at both the onset and the termination of the Younger Dryas were global and were accomplished within the span of a human generation. Again, the comet impact hypothesis makes the best sense of this. The estimated combined explosive force of the impacts at 10 million megatons would have lofted sufficient ejecta into the atmosphere 12,800 years ago to plunge the Earth into a long, sustained twilight, akin to a nuclear winter. The time of darkness that so many ancient myths speak of, capable of reducing solar radiation for more than 1,000 years. The dramatic warming that began 11,600 years ago would then be explained by the final dissipation of the ejecta cloud, coupled with an end to the system-wide inertia that had beset thermohaline circulation in the North Atlantic. Another possibility, not necessarily mutually contradictory with any of the above mechanisms, is that 11,600 years ago, the Earth interacted again with the debris stream of the same fragmenting comet that had caused the Younger Dryas to start 12,800 years ago. On the second occasion, however, analysis suggests that the primary impacts were not on land or onto ice, but into the world's oceans, throwing up vast plumes of water vapor and creating a greenhouse effect that caused global warming rather than global cooling. According to renowned British astronomer Sir Fred Hoyle, the difference between a warm ocean and a cold one amounts to a 10-year supply of sunlight. Thus, the warm conditions produced by a strong water vapor greenhouse must be maintained for at least a decade in order to produce the required transformation of the ocean. And this is just about the time for which water, suddenly thrown into the stratosphere, might be expected to persist there. The needed amount of water is so vast, 100 million million tons, that only one kind of causative event seems possible: the infall of a comet-sized object into a major ocean. More research certainly needs to be done to establish the exact mechanisms, in all their complexity, that brought about the sudden end of the Younger Dryas, but the effects on global climate are already well understood. The Greenland ice cores, those invaluable windows into the past, tell us that temperatures rose in less than a decade at the climate transition marking the end of the Younger Dryas cold interval and the beginning of the warmer Holocene epoch at 11,600 years before the present. In less than 20 years, the climate in the North Atlantic region turned into a milder and less stormy regime as a consequence of a rapid retreat of sea ice cover. A warming of 7 degrees centigrade was completed in about 50 years. In exactly the same interval, in the subalpine belt of Western Europe, tree species that had never been present before, including laris, Pinus cembra, and betula, suddenly began to proliferate. In northwestern Montana, in the USA, glacial ice in the Maria's Pass had receded up valley from the canyon mouth, and the Sun River Glacier had completely vanished by 11,200 years ago. 1,000 other examples could be cited, but the message is the same everywhere. From Tasmania to the Andes, from Turkey to Japan, from North America to Australia, from Peru to Egypt, winter had ended, and a great global spring had begun. Such is the rebirth of the cosmos, as the Hermetic texts proclaim. It is a making again of all things good, a holy and awe-inspiring restoration of all nature. A rebirth, a making again, a restoration. But of what? Who went before? What exactly was to be reborn? We'll consider these questions in the following chapters. Part 3. Sages. Chapter 7. The fire next time. Three singularities occurred near the end of the last ice age, linked to the sudden onset and equally sudden termination of the mysterious epoch known as the Younger Dryas. Somewhere around 12,800 years ago, after more than 2,000 years of uninterrupted global warming, and with a margin of error of plus or minus 150 years that is as close as the resolution of the data allows us to get to the actual moment, a flood of icy meltwater entered the North Atlantic so suddenly and in such quantities that it disrupted ocean circulation. The source of the flood was the North American ice cap. Since the previous two millennia had witnessed continuous sea level rise, the resolution of the data means there's no way of knowing exactly how much coastal land was swallowed up by this singular event. With so much new water that had previously been locked in ice abruptly added, however, we may surmise that a dramatic and instantaneous rise in sea level did occur. In the same geological instant that the meltwater flood was unleashed, global temperatures plummeted, and the world's climate underwent a reversal from that balmy 2,000-year-long summer that had begun about 15,000 years ago. By 13,000 years ago, conditions are thought to have improved to such an extent that they were warmer and wetter than they are today, to a savage and icy global winter. Again, the resolution of the data does not allow us to say exactly how soon after the meltwater flood the deep freeze began, but as we saw in the previous chapter, there is much to suggest that this radical reversal of temperatures was achieved within the span of a single human generation. In that same span, the ice sheets that had everywhere been melting and in retreat began remorselessly to re-advance, and sea level rise ceased. Around 11,600 years ago, again with a margin of error of 150 years in either direction imposed by the data, but again apparently within a single generation, the freeze suddenly ended, global temperatures soared, and the remnant ice caps collapsed, shedding their residual water burden into the world's oceans, which rose dramatically to close to today's level. Our ancestors passed through these tumultuous changes, and it is inconceivable that they would not have remarked upon them or sought to speak about their experiences to one another. Their stories and eyewitness accounts would in turn have become part of revered oral traditions, and as such would have been passed down from generation to generation until they became hoary with age. As the reader will recall from Chapter 3, certain Native American myths do absolutely seem to speak of events at the end of the last ice age. The terrible floods that scoured and ravaged the land are described in detail, but of even greater interest are the traditions of the star with the long white tail that came down here once thousands of years ago, that burnt up everything, and that made a different world in which the weather was colder than before. These traditions appear to memorialize the devastating effects of the comet impact that we can now date conclusively, within the understood margins of error, to around 12,800 years ago. We've seen how scientists Richard Firestone, Alan West, Jim Kennett, and others believe the comet broke into multiple fragments, perhaps eight of which, some with diameters approaching 2 kilometers, hit the North American ice cap, generating huge amounts of heat and instantly transforming great masses of ice into the floods of meltwater that disrupted oceanic circulation and played a key role in bringing on the deep freeze of the Younger Dryas. The reader will also recall that other fragments of the giant comet are thought to have hit the northern European ice cap and to have gone on to rain down on even more distant lands as far away as the Middle East. Thus, though the epicenter was in North America, it's not surprising that the Younger Dryas was a global event that affected peoples and cultures all around the world. What is surprising is the remarkable consistency with which traditions from every part of the globe speak not only of cataclysmic events, but also of very specific warnings given to certain selected wise or good or pure humans in advance of the impending cataclysm. We saw several examples of such warnings in the Native American traditions reviewed in Chapter 3. But if we travel oceans and continents away from the epicenter of the impacts, we find similar accounts of warnings preserved in the Middle East at the furthest extent to which the effects of the comet have so far been documented. Note, this does not mean that the strewn field of comet debris is confined to the 50 million square kilometers presently recognized. It simply means that samples of sediment from other regions have thus far not been assayed for nanodiamonds, magnetic and glassy spherules, melt glass, platinum, and other telltale proxies of impact. Up to the limit of research so far done, however, the site furthest from North America that has produced firm evidence of the presence and effects of the Younger Dryas comet is an archaeological mound or tell called Abu Huraira in Syria, which was excavated in 1974, just before completion of the Takba Dam on the Euphrates River caused it to disappear forever beneath the advancing waters of Lake Assad. Sediment samples from the archaeological trenching of Abu Huraira were removed and preserved before the site was flooded, and it was the Younger Dryas boundary layer of one of these samples, from Trench E, dated to 12,800 years ago, that Firestone, West, Kennett and their team assayed in 2012. As we saw in Chapter 5, they found nanodiamonds, abundant cosmic impact spherules, and melt glass that could only have formed at temperatures in excess of 2,200 degrees Celsius, suggesting that the site was near the center of a high-energy airburst impact. Abu Huraira cannot be subjected to further direct archaeological investigation since it now lies under Lake Assad, but Firestone, Kennett, and West believe the effects of the comet on that settlement and its inhabitants would have been severe. Of note is the fact that the site lies close, both to southeastern Turkey, where Göbekli Tepe is situated, and to the modern state of Iran, formerly Persia, where traditions of great antiquity have been preserved in the scriptures of Zoroastrianism, the pre-Islamic religion of ancient Persia. The fatal winters are going to fall. Exactly how old Zoroastrianism is has not yet been satisfactorily established by scholars, since even the lifetime of its prophet Zarathustra, more usually known as Zoroaster, is uncertain. Indeed, as Columbia University's authoritative Encyclopedia Iranica admits, controversy over Zarathustra's date has been an embarrassment of long standing to Zoroastrian studies. The Greek historians were amongst the first to address themselves to the matter. Plutarch, for example, tells us that Zoroaster lived 5,000 years before the Trojan War, itself a matter of uncertain historicity, but generally put at around 1300 BC. Thus, 5,000 plus 1300 equals 6,300 BC. A similar chronology is given by Diogenes Laertius, who relates that Zoroaster lived 6,000 years before Xerxes' Greek campaign, in other words, around 6,480 BC. More recent scholars have proposed dates as far apart as 1750 BC and 258 years before Alexander, in other words, around 588 BC. Whatever the truth of the matter, it's agreed that Zoroaster himself borrowed from much earlier traditions, and that Zoroastrianism, therefore, like many other religions, has roots that extend very far back into prehistory. In the Zoroastrian scriptures known as the Zend Avesta, certain verses in particular are recognized as drawing on these very ancient oral traditions. The verses speak of a primordial father figure called Yima, the first man, the first king and the founder of civilization, and appear in the opening section of the Zend Avesta, known as the Vendidad. There we read how the god Ahura Mazda created the first land, Ariana Vaejo, by the good river Daicha, as a paradise on earth, and how the fair Yima, the great shepherd, was the first mortal with whom Ahura Mazda chose to converse, instructing him to become a preacher. Yima refused, at which the god set him a different task. "Since thou wantest not to be the preacher and the bearer of my law, then make my world thrive, make my world increase. Undertake thou to nourish, to rule, and to watch over my world." To this Yima agreed, at which the god presented him with a golden ring and a poniard, a long tapered thrusting knife inlaid with gold. Significantly, for we will see in chapter 17 there are close parallels to this story as far away as the Andes Mountains of South America, Yima then pressed the earth with the golden ring and bored it with the poniard. By this act, we learn he made the earth grow larger by one-third than it was before, a feat that over the course of thousands of years he repeated twice more, in the process eventually doubling the land area available for the flocks and herds with men and dogs and birds, who gathered unto him, at his will and wish, as many as he wished. Anatomically modern humans like ourselves have existed, so far as we know, for a little less than 200,000 years. The earliest anatomically modern human skeleton acknowledged by science is from Ethiopia and dates to 196,000 years ago. Within this time span, there has been only one period when those parts of the earth that are useful to humans increased dramatically in size, and that was during the last ice age, between 100,000 and 11,600 years ago. Indeed, previously submerged lands totaling 27 million square kilometers, equivalent to the area of Europe and China added together, were exposed by lowered sea levels at the last glacial maximum 21,000 years ago. While it is probably far-fetched to suppose that it is this very real increase of useful land, of which a great part was still above water at the beginning of the Younger Dryas 12,800 years ago, that is referred to in the Yima story, or that it has anything to do with the Golden Age that Yima's benign rule supposedly achieved in Ariana Vaejo, it is interesting to note what happened next. After another immense span of time, we read, Yima was summoned to a meeting place by the good river Daicha, where the god Ahura Mazda appeared to him, bearing an ominous warning of sudden and catastrophic climate change. "O fair Yima, upon the material world the fatal winters are going to fall, that shall bring the fierce, foul frost. Upon the material world the fatal winters are going to fall, that shall make snowflakes fall thick, even on the highest tops of mountains. Therefore make thee a vara, a hypogeum or underground enclosure, long as a riding ground on every side of the square, and thither bring the seeds of sheep and oxen, of men, of dogs, of birds, and of red blazing fires. Thither thou shalt bring the seeds of men and women of the greatest, best, and finest kinds on this earth. Thither shalt thou bring the seeds of every kind of cattle, of the greatest, best, and finest kinds on this earth. Thither shalt thou bring the seeds of every kind of tree, of the greatest, best, and finest kinds on this earth. Thither shalt thou bring the seeds of every kind of fruit, the fullest of food and the sweetest of odor. All those seeds shalt thou bring, two of every kind, to be kept inexhaustible there, so long as those men shall stay in the Vara. There shall be no hump-backed, none bulged forward there, no impotent, no lunatic, no leprous. So, you get the idea, this underground hideaway was to serve as a refuge from a terrible winter that was about to seize Ayrjana Vallejo, a winter at the onset of which, as the Bundahish, another Zoroastrian text, informs us, the evil spirit sprang like a snake out of the sky down to the earth. He rushed in at noon, and thereby the sky was as shattered and frightened by him as a sheep by a wolf. He came onto the water which was arranged below the earth, and then the middle of this earth was pierced and entered by him. He rushed out upon the whole creation, and he made the world quite as injured and dark at midday as though it were dark night. Studying these accounts, I couldn't help but be reminded of the 2 millennia of warm, fine weather which must indeed have seemed like a golden age, before the sudden, lethal onset of the Younger Dryas 12,800 years ago. The Zoroastrian texts would not be far wrong in describing it as a fierce, foul frost, and as a fatal winter. The evil spirit to whom this affliction is attributed is Angra Mainyu, the agent of darkness, destruction, wickedness, and chaos, who stands in opposition to and seeks to undermine and undo all the good works of Ahura Mazda. For Zoroastrianism is a profoundly dualistic religion, in which human beings and the choices we make for good or evil are seen as the objects of an eternal competition or contest between the opposed forces of darkness and light. And in this contest, the darkness sometimes wins. Thus the Vendidad reminds us that although Ayrjana Vallejo was the first of the good lands and countries created by Ahura Mazda, it could not resist the evil one. Thereupon came Angra Mainyu, who is all death, and he counter-created by his witchcraft the serpent in the river, and winter, a work of the demons. Now there are 10 winter months there, 2 summer months, and these are cold for the waters, cold for the earth, cold for the trees. Winter falls there, with the worst of its plagues. In other translations, the phrase the serpent in the river and winter is given as a great serpent and winter, and alternatively as a mighty serpent and snow. Again, you get the idea. The metaphor that is being repeatedly driven home here is that of the mighty serpent who springs from the sky down to the earth, who penetrates the earth, and who brings a prolonged winter upon the world, so severe that it is dark, most turbid, opaque, according to some translations, at midday, and even the fleeting summer months are too cold for human life. Once again, the whole scenario seems very accurately to describe the terrible conditions that would have afflicted the world after the Younger Dryas comet spread its trail of destruction across at least 50 million square kilometers, brought on a vehement destroying frost, and threw such quantities of dust into the upper atmosphere, together with smoke from the continent-wide wildfires sparked off by air bursts and superheated ejecta, that a turbid, opaque darkness would indeed have filled the skies, reflecting back the sun's rays and perpetuating something very like a nuclear winter for centuries. The Zoroastrian texts leave us in no doubt that these conditions posed a deadly threat to the future survival of civilization. It was for this reason that Ahura Mazda came to Yima with his warning and his instruction to build an underground shelter where some remnant of humanity could take refuge, keeping safe the seeds of all animals and plants until the dire winter had passed and spring returned to the world. Moreover, the account reveals very little that seems mythical or that obviously derives from flights of religious fancy. Rather, the whole thing has about it an atmosphere of hard-headed, practical planning that adds a chilling note of veracity. For example, the admonition that deformed, impotent, lunatic, and leprous people should be kept out of the Vara sounds a lot like eugenics, a distasteful policy to be sure, but one that might be implemented if the survival of the human race was at stake and there was limited space available in the refuge. For the same reasons, it's not surprising that only the seeds of the greatest, best, and finest kinds of trees, fruits, and vegetables, those that are fullest of food and sweetest of odour, are to be brought to the Vara. Why waste space on anything but the best? Also, although it is certain that a number of carefully selected people were to be admitted to the Vara, perhaps as caretakers and managers of the project and as future breeding stock, the emphasis throughout is on seeds, which in the case of human beings would be sperm from the males and eggs from the females. So when we read that the Vara is to be constructed in three subterranean levels, each smaller than the one above, each with its own system of crisscrossing streets, it is legitimate to wonder whether some kind of storage system, perhaps with ranks of shelves arranged in crisscrossing aisles, might not really be what is meant here. In the largest part of the place, thou shalt make 9 streets, 6 in the middle part, 3 in the smallest. To the streets of the largest part, thou shalt bring 1,000 seeds of men and women. To the streets of the middle part, 600. To the streets of the smallest part, 300. If it seems fanciful to imagine that we might, in an almost high-tech sense, be looking at the specifications of a seed bank here, then how are we to assess other technological aspects of the Vara, for example, its lighting system? As well as making a door to the place and sealing it up with the golden ring already given to him by Ahura Mazda, Yima is also to fashion a window, self-shining within. When Yima asks for clarification as to the nature of this self-shining window, Ahura Mazda tells him cryptically, there are uncreated lights and created lights. The former are the stars, the moon and the sun, which will not be seen from within the confines of the Vara during the long winter, but the latter are artificial lights which shine from below. Yima did as he was instructed and completed the Vara, which thereafter glowed with its own light. That accomplished, he then made waters flow in a bed a mile long. There he settled birds by the evergreen banks that bear never-failing food. There he established dwelling places consisting of a house with a balcony, a courtyard, and a gallery. There too, we're reminded, in accord with the commands of the god, he brought the seeds of men and women. There he brought the seeds of every kind of tree and every kind of fruit. All those seeds he brought, 2 of every kind, to be kept inexhaustible there, so long as those men shall stay in the Vara. Finally, we learn that every 40th year, to every couple, 2 are born, a male and a female, and thus it is for every sort of cattle, and the men in the Vara which Yima made live the happiest life. Interestingly, the translator explains in a footnote drawn from various ancient learned commentaries on the text that the human inhabitants of the Vara live there for 150 years. Some say they never die. Moreover, and particularly intriguing, the births of offspring to every couple do not result from sexual union, but from the seeds deposited in the Vara. Other hints of a mysterious lost technology connected to Yima include a miraculous cup in which he could see everything that was happening anywhere in the world, and a jeweled glass throne, sometimes described as a glass chariot, that was capable of flight. Flood and rain. As well as a climate catastrophe, in the form of an overnight reversion to peak ice age cold, we also know that the Younger Dryas involved extensive global flooding as a large fraction of the North American ice cap melted and poured into the world ocean. It is therefore noteworthy that the Zoroastrian texts speak not only of the vehement destroying frost of a global winter, but also of an associated flood accompanied by heavy precipitation in which every single drop of rain became as big as a bowl, and the water stood the height of a man over the whole of this earth. On the other side of the world, and much closer to the North American epicenter of the cataclysm, the Popol Vuh, an original document of the ancient Quiche Maya of Guatemala, based on pre-conquest sources, also speaks of a flood, and associates it with much hail, black rain and mist, and indescribable cold. It says, in a remarkable echo of the Zoroastrian tradition, that this was a period when it was cloudy and twilight all over the world. The faces of the sun and the moon were covered. Other Maya sources confirm that these strange and terrible phenomena were experienced by mankind in the time of the ancients. The earth darkened. It happened that the sun was still bright and clear. Then at midday it got dark. Sunlight was not seen again until the 26th year after the flood. Returning to the Middle East, the famous account of the Hebrew patriarch Noah and the great ark in which he rides out the flood commands attention. It's obvious that there are many parallels with the story of Yima and his Vara. The Vara, after all, is a means of surviving a terrible and devastating winter, which will destroy every living creature by enchaining the earth in a freezing trap of ice and snow. The ark, likewise, is a means of surviving a terrible and devastating flood, which will destroy every living creature by drowning the world in water. In both cases, a deity, Ahura Mazda in the case of the Zoroastrian tradition, the god Yahweh in the case of the Hebrew tradition, intervenes to give advance warning to a good and pure man to prepare for the coming cataclysm. In each case, the essence of the project is to preserve the seeds, or the breeding pairs, of all life. And of every living thing, of all flesh, two of every sort shalt thou bring into the ark to keep them alive with thee. They shall be male and female. Of fowls after their kind, and of cattle after their kind, of every creeping thing of the earth after his kind, two of every sort shall come unto thee to keep them alive. Easily missed but noteworthy is the fact that Noah's ark, like Yima's Vara, is to have a window, is to be closed with a door, and is to consist of three levels. A window shalt thou make to the ark, and in a cubit shalt thou finish it above, and the door of the ark shalt thou set in the side thereof, with lower, second, and third stories shalt thou make it. Last but not least, there are hints of a lost lighting technology in Noah's ark that parallel the references to the artificial lights in the Vara. In The Legends of the Jews, Louis Ginsberg's remarkable and comprehensive compilation of ancient stories and traditions connected to the Hebrew Bible, we read that the whole journey of the ark during the year of the flood was conducted in darkness both by day and by night. All the time it lasted, the sun and the moon shed no light. However, just like the self-shining window of the Vara, the ark was illuminated by a precious stone, the light of which was more brilliant by night than by day, so enabling Noah to distinguish between day and night. Underground cities. Noah's Ark, as is well known, is said to have ended its journey on the slopes of Mount Ararat, the symbolic heartland of ancient Armenia, but now, as a result of wars in the early 20th century, located within the modern state of Turkey. Turkey, in turn, shares a border with Iran, ancient Persia, from which the accounts of Yima's Vara come down to us. It is therefore intriguing that Turkey's Cappadocia region has a very large number of ancient underground structures hewn out of solid rock and usually, like the Vara, consisting of multiple levels stacked one above the other. These underground cities, as they're known, include the eerie and spectacular site of Derinkuyu, which I was able to visit in 2013. Lying beneath a modern town of the same name, eight of its levels are presently open to the public, although further levels remain closed off below, and astonishingly, a subterranean tunnel, several kilometers in length, connects it to another, similar hypogeum at Kaimakli. Entering Derinkuyu was like crossing some invisible barrier into an unexpected netherworld. One minute I was standing in bright sunshine. The next, after I had ducked into the cool, dank, dimly lit system of tunnels and galleries, no self-shining windows now, only low wattage electric light, I felt I had been transported to a realm carved out by mythical dwarves at the dawn of time. In places, the tunnels are low and narrow, so that one must stoop and walk in single file between walls stained and blackened with ancient smoke and overgrown here and there with green mold. At regular intervals, slid back into deep recesses, I passed hulking megalithic doors, shaped like millstones, 5 to 6 feet, 1.5 to 1.8 meters in diameter, and weighing close to half a ton, These were clearly designed to be rolled out to block access. Stairways and steep ramps led down from level to level, and although all the levels were interconnected, the rolling stone doors could be used to isolate them from one another when needed. I noticed a remarkable system of plunging, sheer-sided ventilation shafts connecting the deepest levels with the surface, and doing so to such good effect that the gusts of fresh air were still palpable 80 meters, 260 feet or more beneath the ground. In some places, the passageway I was following would debouch into a junction, where tunnels branched off in several directions and more stairways led down to even lower levels. And here and there, now to one side of the passageway, now to the other, sometimes accessed by means of holes cut in the wall, sometimes through full-sized doorways, lay small, low-ceilinged grottos, in which even a few people sitting together would have felt cramped. But sometimes those doors would lead into interconnected networks of chambers and passages, and sometimes they would open out suddenly into lofty halls and spacious rooms with barrel vault ceilings looming high overhead, supported on monolithic columns hewn from the living rock. The whole place, in short, is a complex and cunning labyrinth on an immense scale, a work of astonishing architectural complexity, that would be impressive if it had been built above ground, but that is utterly breathtaking when one considers that it all had to be mined, chiseled, hammered, cut, and gouged out of the volcanic bedrock. Later, studying a plan, I realized that this vast hypogeum, looking in cross-section like a gigantic rabbit warren and extending over an area of more than 4 square kilometers, lay underfoot wherever one went in the modern town of Derinkuyu, streets beneath streets, rooms beneath rooms, a secret antipodal city of unknown antiquity and of unknown purpose, but certainly the product of immense ingenuity, determination, and skill. And Derinkuyu is just one of 200 such subterranean complexes, each containing a minimum of 2 levels, with around 40 containing 3 levels or more, that have been identified in Turkey in the area between Kayseri and Nevşehir. Moreover, new discoveries are constantly being made. Derinkuyu itself was found in 1963 after builders renovating the cellar of a modern home broke through to an ancient passageway below. And most recently, in 2014, workers preparing the ground for a new housing project at Nevşehir, an hour's drive north of Derinkuyu, stumbled upon yet another unsuspected hypogeum. Archaeologists were called in, and it was quickly realized that this one was bigger than any of the others so far known. As Hasan Unver, mayor of Nevşehir, put it, Derinkuyu and Kaymakli are little more than kitchens when compared to the newly explored site. It is not a known underground city, added Mehmet Ergun Turan, head of Turkey's Housing Development Administration. Tunnel passages of 7 kilometers are being discussed. Naturally, when the discovery was made, we stopped the construction we were planning to do in the area. Several commentators immediately speculated that the newly discovered site might be 5,000 years old, but there is no basis for this, or really for any date. All we can say for sure is that the earliest surviving historical mention of Turkey's underground cities is found in the Anabapsis of the Greek historian Xenophon, written in the 4th century BC. So they are older than that. But the question is, how much older? As the reader will recall from Chapter 1, there's no objective way to date structures made entirely of rock. What archaeologists look for, therefore, are organic materials that can be carbon dated. To be useful, however, these organic materials must be excavated from locations under a megalith that has never been moved, for example, or in the original mortar in a joint between 2 stone blocks, that allow reasonable deductions to be made about the date the associated structural elements were put in place. This is why the mysterious decision by the builders of Göbekli Tepe to bury the megalithic enclosures there has been so helpful to archaeology. Once buried, they stayed buried, and organic materials in the fill can thus be used to make valuable inferences about their age. In many other sites, by contrast, there is the possibility that the intrusion of later organic materials will give a falsely young date, and in some, the underground cities of Turkey being a prime example, no reliable dating can be done. This is because the sites were used, reused, and indeed repurposed many times down the ages by many different peoples, with organic materials being introduced on every occasion, thus making it impossible to draw any inferences about the epoch of their original construction. The general view of archaeologists is that the underground structures were originally developed in the 7th or 8th centuries BC by an Indo-European people called the Phrygians, who lived in Cappadocia at the time. The theory is that the Phrygians began the project by widening and deepening natural caves and tunnels that already existed in the volcanic rock, making use of the spaces they created for storage and possibly as places of refuge from attackers. By Roman times, with the Phrygians long gone, the inhabitants of the area were Greek-speaking Christians who further developed and expanded the underground caverns, rededicating some of the rooms as chapels and leaving inscriptions in Greek, some of which survive to this day. In the Byzantine era, from the 8th to the 12th centuries AD, the Eastern Roman Empire was locked in wars with newly Islamicized Arabs, and the underground cities became places of refuge again, a function they continued to serve during the Mongol invasions of the 14th century AD. Later still, Greek Christians used the cities to escape persecution at the hands of Turkish Muslim rulers, and this practice continued into the 20th century, when the structures finally fell into disuse after the truce and population exchange between Greece and Turkey in 1923. With such a checkered history, it's easy to see why the underground cities cannot be dated using objective archaeological techniques. Moreover, the vast effort that went into their excavation out of solid rock and their sophisticated ventilation systems speak of powerful, long-term motives far beyond the limited and temporary need for shelter from attackers. With this in mind, let us consider a scenario in which the Phrygians, favored for no good reason by archaeologists as the first makers of the cities, were themselves just one of the many later cultures to make use of them. It is perfectly possible that this is the case, and if so, then it is also possible that these extraordinary underground structures might date back to a time long before the Phrygians, perhaps even as far back as the fatal winters of the Younger Dryas that set in around 12,800 years ago. There is no proof of this, of course. Nonetheless, Turkish historian and archaeologist Ömer Demir, author of Cappadocia, Cradle of History, is of the opinion that Derinkuyu does in fact date back to the Paleolithic. His argument is based partly on the notion that it already existed in Phrygian times, partly on stylistic differences between the upper, older levels and the lower, younger levels, and partly on the fact that marks of the implements used to cut the rock have worn completely away in the upper levels but are still visible in the lower levels. It is necessary for a long period of time to pass for the chisel marks to disappear. This means that there was quite a time difference between the years of construction of the first stories and the last stories. Demir also suggests that the huge quantities of rock excavated to make the underground city, which are nowhere in evidence in the vicinity today, were dumped into local streams and carried off. In one of these streams, the Sognali, at a distance of 26 kilometers, 16 miles from Derinkuyu, hand axes, rock chips, and other Paleolithic artifacts were found. The evidence is suggestive at best. I wouldn't want to bet my life or my reputation on it. Nonetheless, the scenario that sees Derinkuyu and the other underground cities constructed in the Upper Paleolithic around 12,800 years ago at the onset of the Younger Dryas has the great merit of no longer leaving us casting about for a motive commensurate with the huge effort involved. We're informed of that motive quite explicitly in the story of Yima. Stated simply, the cities are varas, cut down into the depths of the earth as places of refuge from the horrors of the Younger Dryas, which were not limited to the vehement destroying frost, but as we know from the cosmic impact spherules and melt glass found in sediment samples at nearby Abu Huraira, also included the terrifying threat of bombardment from the skies. Like a snake out of the sky. It is close to certain, if our planet did indeed cross the path of a giant comet 12,800 years ago, as Firestone, Kennett, and West maintain, that the bombardment would not have been limited to the large fragments that came down during the first event. the comet's debris stream would have remained on an Earth-crossing orbit and would very likely have resulted in decades, perhaps even centuries, of subsequent bombardments, not on the same scale of intensity as the initial encounter, but nonetheless able to cause catastrophic damage and to spread enough fear and dismay of the mighty serpent lingering in the heavens to justify the construction of secure underground shelters. Indeed, as we will see, the Earth may still cross the debris stream of the giant Younger Dryas comet today, and large, deadly objects, blacker than coal, invisible to our telescopes, may still be orbiting in that stream today. I'm reminded again of the Ojibwa prophecy, reviewed in Chapter 3. The star with the long white tail is going to destroy the world someday, when it comes low again. That's the comet called Long-Tailed Heavenly Climbing Star. Is the Younger Dryas comet coming back? Could it be that it did not spend all its anger and destructive force with the fragments that hit the Earth and caused the vehement destroying winter of the Younger Dryas 12,800 years ago? Curiously, the ancient Iranian traditions contain a prophecy also, for it is said that Yima will return and will walk again amongst men when the signs foreshadowing the last of days appear. Of these, the worst will be a winter more terrible than any the world has seen before, when it will rain and snow and hail for 3 long years. The fiery descent of more fragments of the comet could bring about such a winter, just as happened 12,800 years ago. And just as happened then, it would do so in part because the skies would be darkened by debris and smoke from the wildfires caused by airbursts and by the superheated ejecta from the impacts on land. These are grave matters, and we will return to them in Chapter 19. But first we must consider the story of Noah, the Hebrew counterpart of Yima, carried by the waters of the flood, so we are told, to the slopes of Mount Ararat, just a few days' walk from Göbekli Tepe. The Noah story also contains a prophecy, which is made manifest in the New Testament, 2 Peter 3, verses 3 to 7. By water, the world of that time was deluged and destroyed. By the same word, the present heavens and earth are reserved for fire, being kept for the day of judgment and destruction of ungodly men. Or as the old song has it, God gave Noah the rainbow sign. No more water. The fire next time. Chapter 8. The Antediluvians. The biblical story of the deluge is too familiar to require extensive repetition here. The essential elements can be summarized as follows. A life-destroying global flood sent by God to punish human wickedness. A man, Noah, selected by God, and given advance warning of the coming cataclysm so that he can build a survival ship, the Ark. The preservation in the Ark of the seeds or breeding pairs of all forms of life, with a particular emphasis on human life. Noah and his wife, together with their sons and their wives, and animal life, of fowls after their kind, as we saw in the last chapter, and of cattle after their kind, of every creeping thing of the earth after his kind, two of every sort shall come unto thee to keep them alive. The ark rides out the flood until the waters subside. The ark comes to rest on the mountains of Ararat. When the waters have dried up from the earth, God instructs Noah to leave the ark with his family and to bring out every kind of living creature that is with you, the birds, the animals, and all the creatures that move along the ground, so they can multiply on the earth and be fruitful and increase in number on it. Noah builds an altar on which he sacrifices some of the animals and birds that he has just saved from the flood. The smell of the burnt offerings is pleasing to God. The surviving humans and animals go forth and multiply and fill the earth, as they have been commanded. Mount Ararat rises to 5,137 meters, 16,853 feet, and geologists assure us, on the basis of excellent science, that no part of it has ever been covered by oceanic floodwaters since it began to take shape as a mountain near the end of the early Miocene, some 16 million years ago. The presence of anatomically modern humans in the world, as we saw in the last chapter, cannot be traced back further than 200,000 years, and even the last common ancestor with the chimpanzee, a creature that was very far from being in any sense human, takes us back barely 6 million years. So the notion of a boat, with humans on board, being washed up on Mount Ararat is a chronological impossibility. Nonetheless, it is intriguing that the story of the deluge as given in the Old Testament makes specific and deliberate mention of the mountains of Ararat. The mount does in fact have twin peaks, which in biblical times were understood as being part of the kingdom of Ararat, the historic land of Urartu, conquered by the Assyrian king Shalmaneser in the late 2nd millennium BC. Due to the limited archaeology that has been undertaken in the region, historians confess that the origins of Urartu must remain obscure, but the earliest known settlements and the beginnings of agriculture in the region have been traced back to approximately 10,000 to 9,000 BC, in other words, to the period of Göbekli Tepe. Moreover, this whole area, Mount Ararat and Göbekli Tepe very much included, formed the heartland of historic Armenia, the direct descendant of the biblical kingdom of Ararat, whose inhabitants saw, and still today see themselves, as the peoples of Ararat. Written in the 5th century AD, Moses Korenatsi's influential History of the Armenians attributed the founding of the nation to the patriarch Haik, who it was said was the great-great-great-grandson of Noah himself, and thus in the close lineage of the flood survivors who emerged from the ark. Indeed, it is because of Haik that even in the 21st century Armenians still refer to themselves as Hai and to their land as Hayastan. They see it simply as a tragedy of history that so much of this land, again including Göbekli Tepe and Mount Ararat, is now in the possession of the Republic of Turkey following the Armenian genocide of 1915 to 1923, in which more than 1 million ethnic Armenians are believed to have been killed by Turkish forces. Nationalistic feelings still run high in the communities of the Armenian diaspora scattered around the world, and in the tiny rump of historic Armenia that forms the Armenian Republic today. These tensions have not left Göbekli Tepe untouched, and many Armenians are outraged that Turkey claims this uniquely important site as its own heritage, as though the ancient Armenian connection did not even exist. A few minutes' search on the internet using the keyword Portasar, the former Armenian name of Göbekli Tepe, will confirm this. I'll give a single example here, a YouTube video entitled Turkey Presents Armenian Portasar as Turkish Göbekli Tepe. Amongst the comments, fairly typical of the remarks made by many viewers, we read, "This is the way I look at Portasar, Göbekli Tepe. These people deliberately buried a sacred temple. They did this in the anticipation of having it discovered many years in the future. They believed in reincarnation. Those people who built Portasar, Göbekli Tepe, are here among the Armenians. Their spirits have transcended into the Armenian people of today. When you pass on something in your family, you want to make sure that it goes to only that family member and no one else. Portasar and those lands will be returned back to the Armenians in accordance with the laws of nature." In the same vein, though now entirely within the borders of Turkey, Mount Ararat remains a potent symbol of Armenian nationalism. A landscape of Mount Ararat, with the floodwaters receding and Noah's Ark at the summit, dominates the coat of arms of the Republic of Armenia, while the mountain itself, so near and yet so far, looms over the Armenian capital city Yerevan, a haunting and ever-present reminder that the past is never dead. It's not even past. Thus, there are many ways in which the story of Noah and his ark, and of a world made anew after a terrible global cataclysm, is still a living force in the region of Göbekli Tepe, that mysterious sanctuary in the Taurus Mountains, where the great stone circles began to be put in place in 9600 BC, a date that marks the exact end of the long, fatal winter of the Younger Dryas. As Klaus Schmidt asked me rhetorically when I interviewed him at the site, see chapter 1, how likely is it to be an accident that the monumental phase at Göbekli Tepe starts in 9600 BC, when the climate of the whole world has taken a sudden turn for the better, and there's an explosion in nature and in possibilities? There's something else about that date, too. Just as the beginning of the Younger Dryas in 10,800 BC was accompanied by huge global floods and an episode of rapidly rising sea levels as icy meltwater from the North American ice cap poured suddenly into the Atlantic Ocean, so too a second global flood occurred around 9,600 BC as the remnant ice caps in North America and Northern Europe collapsed simultaneously amidst worldwide global warming. The late Cesare Emiliani, professor in the Department of Geological Sciences at the University of Miami, carried out isotopic analysis of deep-sea sediments that produced striking evidence of cataclysmic global flooding between 12,000 and 11,000 years ago. So although the floods at the end of the Ice Age could never have carried Noah and his ark thousands of feet above present sea level to the slopes of Mount Ararat, they were indeed global in their extent and would have had devastating consequences for humans living at that time. Mountainous regions such as the Ararat Range would have been natural places of refuge, natural places to bring the seeds of all life, and to start again. Therefore, while the Noah story cannot be literally true in every detail, we must consider the possibility that it is true in its essence, in other words, that it does record the construction of an ark, in which seeds of useful plants and breeding pairs of animals were perhaps preserved by people who already knew agriculture and who possessed architectural skills, who survived the flood, who migrated to the lands between Mount Ararat and Göbekli Tepe, and who subsequently disseminated agricultural and architectural knowledge to the indigenous hunter-gatherers of that region. The sudden and indeed completely unprecedented appearance of giant stone circles at Göbekli Tepe, which surely could only have been conceived and implemented by people with extensive prior experience of megalithic architecture, and the simultaneous invention of agriculture in the exact same locale, are, in my view, highly suggestive of this possibility. Then, too, there is the haunting sense that Göbekli Tepe itself constitutes a kind of ark, frozen and memorialized in stone, for its iconography is not only all about animals, but also in a number of intriguing reliefs that show women with exposed genitalia and males with erect penises about human fertility. Imagery of the latter sort, including a figure that Carl Lukert, professor of the history of religions at Missouri State University, interprets as a classic Earth Mother, calls to mind God's command to Moses and his family to be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. Meanwhile, where else but in Noah's Ark can we find a menagerie as eclectic as the one portrayed on the megaliths of Göbekli Tepe? A menagerie, as we saw in Chapter 1, that includes spiders, scorpions, and snakes, every creeping thing of the earth, birds and cattle, fowls after their kind and cattle after their kind, and foxes, felines, goats, sheep, gazelles, boars, bears, etc., etc. In short, as Genesis 6 verse 20 has it, every kind of animal and every kind of creature. A final touch. Noah sacrificed some of the animals and birds that he had just saved from the flood as an offering to God. At Göbekli Tepe, archaeologists have found the butchered bones of many of the animal species depicted on the megalithic pillars. Cities from before the flood. It has long been recognized by scholars that the biblical flood narrative is not original to the Old Testament, but was borrowed from a much earlier source. Indeed, a source dating back to the oldest true civilization so far acknowledged by archaeology, ancient Sumer, in Mesopotamia, which arose in the 5th millennium BC, flourished during the 4th and 3rd millennia BC, and survived into the 2nd millennium BC. The two earliest surviving written versions of this global flood myth can be seen today at the University of Pennsylvania Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology, and in the private Schøyen collection in Norway. Both are written in cuneiform characters in the Sumerian language, and both have come down to us as fragments rather than complete texts. Of the two, however, it is the University of Pennsylvania tablet, found during excavations of the Sumerian city of Nippur, located on the Euphrates 200 kilometers south of the modern city of Baghdad, that is the most complete, consisting of the lower third of what was once a six-column tablet of baked clay, and dated to the 17th century BC. The Shoyan tablet, though less of it survives, is a little older, dated to the 19th to the 18th centuries BC, repeats some of the lines of the Pennsylvania fragment, and adds a few new details not found elsewhere. What rare and precious things these little broken slabs of baked mud are, and what a tale they have.